in a world plagued by greed, Limp Bizkit, and Barry Manilow. One station stands alone, ejaculating a contemptuous load into the face of mainstream mediocrity. For profit, the system told them what was good. Chaos played them what they wanted to hear. This summer, if you only see one movie, we don't care because we're a radio station. Chaos, it doesn't have to make sense.
Sorry, I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
All right, for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 92.7 in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio, and this one's dedicated to Elizabeth and David, because he is blessed who honors his teachers. Y'all, there's some Beastie Boys. Get the day started off for you. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks for tuning into the show. It's Anti-War Radio on Chaos in Austin. We're streaming live at chaosradioaustin.org and at antiwar.com/radio, where we keep the archives of all the foreign policy interviews from this show. And scotthortonshow.com is where we keep the archives of all the MP3 interviews, more than 700 of them, going back to April 2003. ScottHortonShow.com, and I got a pretty good show lined up for you today. I've got some important news to cover, as well as a good interview lined up for the second hour. The best Western reporter in Iraq by a long shot is Patrick Coburn, and he'll be here in the second hour to talk about the situation in Iraq. Because that's the most important thing in the world, right? Yeah. I'm pretty sure it is, yeah. Okay, I haven't gotten a chance to listen to this Dick Cheney interview yet. Have you guys? I only heard the part where he says, yeah, I'm a torturer. What? That's what I thought. That was the only part I got to hear. So let's take a listen. This is Darth Cheney's exit interview with ABC News.
How important have your administration's policies on surveillance, interrogation, and detention been in protecting the homeland?
Well, I think they've been crucial, Jonathan. I think that anybody who looked at the situation the morning after the 9/11 attack would never have bet that we'd been able to go this long without another attack. We've been able to defeat or disrupt all further attempts to strike the homeland. It's enormously important. I think those programs are crucial.
But you've heard leaders in incoming Congress saying that this policy has basically been torture and illegal wiretapping, and that they want to undo basically the central tenets of your anti-terrorism policy.
They're wrong. On the question of so-called torture, we don't do torture. We never have. It's not something that this administration subscribes to. Again, we proceeded very cautiously. We checked. We had the Justice Department issue the requisite opinions in order to know where the bright lines were that you could not cross. Did it produce the desired results? I think it did. I think, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the number three man in Al-Qaeda, the man who planned the attacks of 9/11, provided us with a wealth of information. There was a period of time there, three or four years ago, when about half of everything we knew about Al-Qaeda came from that one source. So it's been a remarkably successful effort. I think the results speak for themselves. And I think those who allege that we've been involved in torture or that somehow we violated the Constitution or laws with the terrorist surveillance program simply don't know what they're talking about.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it.
In hindsight, do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
More than 2 years ago, President Bush said that he wanted to close down Guantanamo Bay. Why has that not happened?
If you're going to close Guantanamo, what are you going to do with those prisoners? One suggestion is, well, we bring them to the United States. Well, I don't know very many congressmen, for example, who were eager to have 200 Al-Qaeda terrorists deposited in their district. These are not American citizens. They are not subject, nor do they have the same rights that an American citizen does vis-a-vis the government. But they are well-treated. They also have the opportunity, and the process has started now, to be heard before a military commission with a judgment, fair and honest judgment made about their guilt or innocence, to be represented by counsel provided through that process. So they, I don't know any in the nation of the world that would do what we've done in terms of taking care of people who are avowed enemies, and many of whom still swear up and down that their only objective is to kill more Americans.
So when do you think we'll be at a point where Guantanamo could be responsibly shut down?
Well, I think that would come with the end of the war on terror.
When's that going to be?
Well, nobody knows. Nobody can specify that.
On Sunday, John McCain said that the national security team that has been established by President-elect Obama, Clinton, James Jones, Robert Gates, that this is a team that he could have assembled. How do you assess this incoming team?
Well, I must say, I think it's a pretty good team. I'm not close to Barack Obama, obviously, nor am I do I identify with him politically. He's a liberal, I'm a conservative. But I think the idea of keeping Gates at defense is excellent. I think Jim Jones will be very, very effective as the national security advisor. And while I would not have hired Senator Clinton, I think she's tough, she's smart. She works very hard, and she may turn out to be just President Obama needs.
What do you say to those that say you've changed? I mean, you've seen Brent Scowcroft says, I don't know Dick Cheney anymore. I mean, really, he's known you as long as just about anybody in this town. What do you say to that?
Well, the way I think of it is in terms of whether or not I changed, I think a prime motivation for me in much of what I've done was 9/11. Have I changed? Well, not in the sense that I've gone through some, you know, fundamental psychological transition here, but I have been, since that day, focused very much upon what we needed to do to defend the nation. And I think the policies we've recommended, the programs that we've undertaken, have been good programs. I think those have been sound decisions. And if that's what they mean by saying I changed, I'm guilty.
All right, Mr. Vice President, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, geez, I could have thought of a bunch of questions to ask that didn't make it into that interview. But I got to tell you, this kid, Jonathan, whoever the hell he is, boy, he seems scared to death of this guy, which I guess is understandable. I mean, who here among us thinks that it's perfectly okay to piss off Dick Cheney and then not have to worry about the safety of your family? Your own life, the chances that you're, you know, the dice that you're rolling about whether you're going to have a single car accident on the way home. Wow. Yeah. So Dick Cheney. Well, there's a few things to I think, bring up about what he said in that interview with ABC News. First of all, the part about Scowcroft says you've changed. Dick Cheney, I've known for 30 years. Dick Cheney, I don't know anymore, says Brent Scowcroft, one of the leading figures of the American establishment. What happened? And Cheney says, oh, well, you know, I was only trying to protect you, blah, blah, blah. Here's what happened. He got absolute power. Before, he was just the Secretary of Defense. Just the Chief of Staff. When he became Vice President of the United States, with George Bush Jr. in the chair, he attained absolute power. He was the conspiracy behind the throne. And virtually every evil thing that the Bush administration has done was organized and planned and run out of the vice president's office. It wasn't 9/11 that changed him. It was having absolute power. And we all know that when the Cheney Energy Task Force met, that they were planning on stealing Iraq long before 9/11. Paul O'Neill, who was from Alcoa, seemed, that ought to be Republican enough for you, right? The CEO of Alcoa? Well, he was the first Treasury Secretary, and he says they were talking about invading Iraq in the very first cabinet meeting. What do you say? Something like, it's like having a blind man leading a room full of stupid people or something like that. As they were trying to come up with excuses for invading Iraq. It was the absolute power, not the 9/11 attack, that changed Dick Cheney. Obviously. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. Yeah, that's how that works. Secondly, I think it's important to note, and I will have to get a good soundbite of just this clip by itself. Dick Cheney thinks that Barack Obama's national security team is great. Oh, gee, well, you know, he's a liberal and I'm a conservative. But yeah, other than that, I think his national security team that he's putting together is perfect. You know, my roommate is, he's just not a political guy at all. He couldn't care less. Poor bastard's got to sit here and put up with me a lot of times. But I said to him, I said, hey, did you hear that Dick Cheney said that Barack Obama's foreign policy team is awesome? And he said to me, wait, what? Wait, Cheney said that? About Obama's guys? Oh, well, that's bad, right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid that's bad, dude. This guy, Jim Jones, literally Jim Jones. Literally, the guy's name is Jim Jones, wants to put NATO forces in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Huh? How's that for, uh-oh. How about they've already handed out or promised to hand out a one-way official in writing war guarantee to Israel, promising to blast people off the face of the earth with nuclear weapons if they ever mess with that state. Something that's a policy far to the right of what Cheney ever did. And I guess it was assumed that if anybody ever nuked Israel, not like there's any enemies of Israel that have any nuclear weapons or are even attempting to construct them. But, you know, under the hypothetical, I think everybody assumed that Cheney would nuke anybody. If somebody had nuked Israel, that the United States would nuke them. Kind of went without saying. Obama decided to come out and say it, just like he came out and said, yeah, we ought to push all the Arabs. Oh, I guess this was the silent understood part at the beginning of the sentence. We need to push all the last of the Arabs out of Jerusalem and make it a single Jewish-controlled Israeli city. In his APAC speech, again, to the, if you call it the right, okay, the right, to the warmongerer side of even Dick Cheney himself. Also in that interview, when can we get these guys out of Guantanamo? When can we close this system of extrajudicial weird court thing that you guys are doing there? Cheney says, well, when the war on terror ends. And the interviewer says, when's that? And he says, nobody knows. The rest of your life, pal, and your kids too. Decades. As long as any stateless group of human beings on this planet is willing to resort to violence to resist the American empire, we will have a war on terrorism. Get it? Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting the way, you know, he asked him about Guantanamo. Oh, yeah, all evil people, the worst. And I don't know any congressmen who are willing to let their district become full of Al-Qaeda detainee terrorist guys. Really? You've released hundreds so far, Dick Cheney. Hundreds and hundreds of people. Like 400, 500 something people have been released from Guantanamo Bay. Were they all the worst of the worst too? People held for 7 years without any trial, without any process whatsoever, and then just sent back? Of course, everybody in their neighborhood assumes they're a snitch, or else why would they have been released? And these people have to live the rest of their life like that, assuming, you know, that they can even get out of bed from all the flashbacks of the torture they've suffered. Assuming they can go outside, they got to deal with the whole town treating them like Dick Cheney's MKUltra spy for the rest of their lives. These worst of the worst people who he's just let go by the hundreds because, of course, he had nothing on them whatsoever. And in fact, there's an article today in the London Telegraph. Guantanamo prisoner, quote, never questioned about his alleged crime. Former prisoner at Guantanamo Bay has said he was tortured but never questioned about the main allegations against him during almost 7 years of captivity. And now this goes to the other 16 words. And I bet you if you just want to go around and block out parts of Bush's 2002 State of the Union address by the 16 words at a time, I bet you can find 10 different lies contained in 16 words. But beyond just the citing the obviously forged documents accusing Saddam Hussein of trying to buy completely unrefined uranium from Niger, there was another set of 16 words that, well, somebody else did the homework and identified for me, and that was accusing some Bosnian men of plotting to blow up the American embassy. It wasn't true. All they had done was gotten wind of a plot that the Bosnian authorities suspected, but then cleared these men and let them go. And the Bush guy said, no way, this would be a great talking point in our State of the Union speech. So rearrest them, Bosnia, or I forgot whether it was or we'll kill you, or if it was or we'll never give you any money again, one or the other of those. And so these Bosnian men were arrested and sent to Guantanamo Bay. You might recognize the name Bomadine, and I know I'm not pronouncing it right. But anyway, the guy, he's the famous Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court said that, no, the president cannot suspend the writ of habeas corpus. Only Congress can do that, and they haven't. And in the Constitution, they can only do that when in case of invasion or rebellion inside the country, and neither of those circumstances exist, and so everybody gets a writ of habeas corpus. How do you like that? That was the Bomadine case. He was one of these guys. And now here are his associate, his friend, whoever this guy is, Mustafa Ait Idir, an Algerian who was freed this week and allowed to move to Bosnia, had been accused of planning to travel to Afghanistan to wage jihad against American forces, says, quote, "They never asked me about the charges that were brought against us. They never asked me about Afghanistan." You see, Dick Cheney just needed a bunch of warm bodies so he could say, see, war on terrorism, see, Al-Qaeda. In fact, he just kidnapped a bunch of innocent people and tortured them. And it's true that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was there, and I believe, not because Dick Cheney says so, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed actually was the ringleader of the 9/11 plot and ought to be hung for it. But the problem is you can't hang him now because you can't give him an actual trial without being forced to admit that you already tortured him and that the confessions that you got out of him came with the waterboard. And of course, you know, Cheney cites Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, says, oh yeah, half of what we know about Al-Qaeda came from torturing this guy. Well, we've all read his confession in Guantanamo Bay, and at least three quarters of it is made up bullshit, and everybody knows it. Guy takes credit for every terrorist plot ever. And of course, we're just not supposed to remember that Dick Cheney lied us into war in Iraq based on the tortured testimony of Sheikh Al-Libi, who, I forgot, I think they took him to Morocco to torture him, or was it Egypt, I forgot, and they tortured him into saying that Saddam Hussein trained them in the use of chemical weapons, that Saddam Hussein trained them in how to hijack airplanes. Oh yeah, you can read all about it at the Weekly Standard, it's all true, never mind the needles under this guy's fingernails at the time that he's blabbing. And as you and I and everyone in our entire society now understands, what they tortured out of Sheikh Al-Libi was a pack of lies. You would tell lies too if Dick Cheney was torturing you. Oh, Saddam Hussein? That's right. Taught us how to use chemical weapons. Right there in his chemical weapons factory. Oh yeah. Whatever you do, please take the needles out from under my fingernails. Thank you. And of course, Hamdan, who's another famous name because the Supreme Court smashed down Bush and Cheney's asserted but non-existent executive powers in the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. They tortured him into giving every orange alert. Remember during the entire run-up to the Iraq War, orange alert every 4 days? Oh, they're going to blow up this, they're going to blow up that. And now never mind all the bogus torture cases. I suppose we could go over those. But what about just the orange alerts? Oh, they're going to blow up a school here. They're going to blow up a bridge there. They're going to crash an airplane into this or crash an airplane into that. All that was tortured out of Hamdan. None of it was true. None of it was true. And yet that was the atmosphere in which we went to war in Iraq. Orange alert. Orange alert. Terrorists are going to kill you. Terrorists are going to kill you. How do we know? We tortured it out of this poor schmuck Hamdan. That's how we know. Just like they tortured Binyam Mohammed with razor blades, they mutilated his genitals until he would admit that he and Jose Padilla were plotting to set off a radioactive dirty bomb. This is the wonderful intelligence. Half of all we know about Al-Qaeda comes from torturing people, Cheney says. And of course, as I was reading to you out of the Senate report the other day, they copied the torture techniques directly from the Chinese Communist North Korean War era torture manuals that, as we all know, were designed to create coerced false confessions. You've seen the Manchurian Candidate, right? Not the Denzel Washington one, but with old blue eyes. What's his name in it? Frank Sinatra. You've seen that, haven't you? The Manchurian Candidate? We all know that was the whole point of Chinese communist torture, don't we? That it was to get innocent people to come out, or at least, you know, whatever, get people to come out and confess to things that they had not done. That they were to confess to specific things that they were, in fact, innocent of. And, could it possibly be that's why Dick Cheney decided? He and his lawyer, David Addington, decided to adopt the torture policies of the Chinese communists? Are you doubtful of that? That what he was after was a bunch of false assertions from Sheikh al-Libi pointing the finger at Saddam Hussein, a bunch of false terrorist threats against your neighborhood out of the mouth of Hamdan? And of course, he says it was the CIA's idea to torture people, and I'm certainly not exonerating anyone at the CIA. George Tenet certainly ought to be swinging from a rope. And in fact, I think George Tenet, his body ought to be left hanging from that rope until his corpse is so rotten that his body goes ahead and separates from his neck, and his head falls out of the noose in a rotten splat on the ground, is what I think ought to happen to George Tenet. Only for all the crimes he committed. I still think he should get a grand jury and a petit jury and a bunch of appeals, and then he should be sentenced to hang from a rope. But, you know, only for being a felon, only for breaking the law. But still, let's get real. It was Dick Cheney and David Addington who said, let's torture people because it's fucking fun. Let's do it. And they came up with excuses to do it. As John McCain explains in the new Senate Armed Services Committee declassified executive summary of their new report, they set about to manipulate the legalisms to make it appear as though what they were doing was legal, knowing full well that it was not. And that was, of course, Dick Cheney and David Addington were the ringleaders behind this whole thing, and everybody knows it. There's a few other things I wanted to mention about, well, I guess I'll just wrap up complaining about that Dick Cheney interview with his invocation of the terrorist surveillance program. We all know it was not a terrorist surveillance program. It was a any American who calls overseas surveillance program. Any American who receives a phone call from across our border surveillance program. That is a fact. We know that they took the total information awareness of Admiral Poindexter and moved it to the National Security Agency. At least for a time, it was called basketball. And we know that they are every day abusing the national security letter powers and the administrative subpoena powers in the Patriot Act. As they've admitted, thousands of these administrative subpoenas have gone out all over the place, complete with gag orders on the people who are served with them. We know they tap the phone of basically whoever they feel like on the National Security Agency level. Hell, you can read The Shadow Factory by the great intelligence reporter James Bamford all about where he interviews the people who were doing the listening. The people who were doing the eavesdropping. And you know what they were listening to? American soldiers in Iraq talking to their wife back home in the middle of the night. Baby, I love you. I miss you. That's what they were sitting around listening to. They were wiretapping journalists, wiretapping the Red Cross, wiretapping Amnesty International and every non-governmental organization on the ground, Human Rights Watch, and everybody else on the ground in Iraq. Especially monitoring journalists. Oh, terrorist surveillance program. Dick Cheney is a felon. An open, admitted, law-breaking felon. 5 years per count. According to the FISA statute, which is a criminal statute. Which says, if you go around, you government employees acting under the color of law, go around tapping people's phones without getting a regular plain old criminal search warrant from a regular judge or getting a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court warrant to target people who may be tied to a foreign power or terrorist group, then you are a felon and you go to prison for 5 years per count. And I forget if it's a $10,000 or $100,000 fine per count. It's a criminal statute. And Dick Cheney's what, like 67 or something? 65? That's the rest of his life behind bars just for the wiretapping. Because the Fourth Amendment is the law, and because the FISA statute is the law, Dick Cheney is a felon. And if there really was such a thing as a law, he would spend the rest of his bloody-handed life in a cage, a filthy government cage, like an animal. until he dies. Because that's what he deserves, morally and legally. That is the law of this great country. Our wonderful representative democracy back in 1978 passed this FISA law. And it says if you violate this thing, we put you in prison. So, you know, it's very interesting to me that Dick Cheney just comes right out. He doesn't even care. What are you going to do about it? That's what I thought. Oh, it's not torture. Yeah, we waterboarded that guy. That is, drown him almost to death over and over again. But we don't torture people. Whatever. You just confessed to participating in a conspiracy to torture people. I don't care if you want to sit here and tell me not to call it torture. Torture is torture, and it already has a definition beyond just what you would have us believe, Mr. Cheney. And it already has a definition in federal law beyond which he would have us believe. Oh, it only means, you know, torture to the point of organ failure or death or no, sorry. That's just you and David Addington and Jay Bybee and John Yoo the rest of you criminals pretended redefinition of torture. But words have meaning. And torture has a legal definition in this society. And if there was a law, we all know what would happen to Dick Cheney. He would swing from a rope. Because that's the law. Oh, come on, Scott. Laws of war don't apply during wartime. Oh, wait a minute. I guess that is what they're for, huh? All right, apply the law. Hang Dick Cheney. Fear. This goes out to the Chaos Crew. right then. That's some fear for you on Chaos Radio. And I don't know if you guys saw the editorial in the New York Times, the torture report. New York Times. Well, talk about whichever way the wind blows. These people are like the Naomi Wolf of writing stuff. Oh, whatever you think, yeah. Yeah, that's what I think too. Well, so apparently enough of us think that George Bush and Dick Cheney ought to be prosecuted and hung from ropes for their deliberate, open, and confessed multiple violations of the war crimes statutes that the New York Times has decided to hop on board. Most Americans have long known that the horrors of Abu Ghraib were not the work of a few low-ranking sociopaths. All but President Bush's most unquestioning supporters recognize the chain of unprincipled decisions that led to the abuse, torture, and death, that is, murder, in prisons run by the American military and intelligence services. Now, a bipartisan report by the Senate Armed Services Committee has made what amounts to a strong case for bringing criminal charges against former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, his legal counsel William J. Haynes, and potentially other top officials, including the former White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez and David Addington, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff. The report shows how actions by these men, quote, led directly to what happened at Abu Ghraib in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and in secret CIA prisons. It said these top officials charged with defending the Constitution and America's standing in the world, this is a New York Times editorial, methodically introduced interrogation practices based on illegal tortures devised by Chinese agents during the Korean War. Until the Bush administration, their only use in the United States was to train soldiers to resist what might be done to them if they were captured by a lawless enemy. The officials then issued legally and morally bankrupt documents to justify their actions, starting with a presidential order saying that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to prisoners of the War on Terror, the first time any democratic nation had unilaterally reinterpreted the conventions. That order set the stage for the infamous redefinition of torture at the Justice Department and then Mr. Rumsfeld's authorization of aggressive interrogation methods. Some of those methods were torture by any rational definition, and many of them violate laws and treaties against abusive and degrading treatment. These top officials ignored warnings from lawyers in every branch of the armed forces that they were breaking the law, subjecting uniformed soldiers to possible criminal charges, and authorizing abuses that were not only considered by experts to be ineffective, but were actually counterproductive. And it goes on like that. There you go. New York Times saying maybe it is time to go ahead and bring in a special prosecutor to see about indicting the vice president and his co-conspirators who rewrote and pretended with, as they say, bankrupt legal documents, trying to pretend that somehow the president, as commander-in-chief, has the authority to violate any law that he wishes, redefine any word in the world to mean what he wants it to mean, and it doesn't really work like that. Now, we all know that none of this is going to happen, but I think, I don't know, Greenwald makes a point on his blog today that, or maybe last night, that this really is something. You know, Senator Levin was on the Rachel Maddow show, and she kept pushing him and pushing him, and Carl Levin basically admitted that, yeah, perhaps this is the kind of thing that we've got to get a special prosecutor on this case to see about how many life terms in prison George Bush and Dick Cheney ought to spend. Oh, okay, he didn't say it like that. And that means something. It doesn't mean that the law is actually going to be applied to these men. We all know better than that. But it sort of means something that at least finally now senators are willing to talk about. It would be appropriate. The New York Times editorial page, finally now willing to talk about the fact that, what we've known since 2004, what we've known since The Gray Zone by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine. Never mind the 10 million pages worth of data that has come out since then on the topic. Donald Rumsfeld gave the order. Grab whom you must, do what you want, take the gloves off. There is no law. We can do whatever we want. And they tortured people to death. They didn't arrest them. They kidnapped them. They didn't aggressively interrogate them. They tortured them. And many of them, well over 100 anyway, have died of it. That's right. Kidnapping, torture, and murder. Those are crimes. Get it? You see how that works? Even if there's a big, neat red, white, and blue flag blowing in the wind nearby, kidnapping, torture, and murder is still a felony. And it's amazing because, you know, as again, Greenwald quotes one of these liberal bloggers talking about, oh, gee, but you know, they were just trying to defend us and it was a crisis and everything. What are you saying? That because you, liberal blogger, gave George Bush carte blanche in your fear that somehow that means it's okay for him to torture people? Well, maybe you just ought to kill yourself as an accessory. And I'm not talking about Glenn. I'm talking about the guy he's quoting there. I forgot the guy's name. But, oh, gee, you know, I'm a liberal blogger with a conscience, and you know, I'm not sure if George Bush should be tortured for this, because after all, this is what I asked for. So, why don't you throw yourself off of something tall if you feel that bad about it? Just because you helped cheerlead a torture regime and helped give carte blanche to a government to kidnap and torture and murder whoever they wanted because you were scared doesn't justify any crime that they committed. That's why they're the laws of war. They do apply during wartime. Oh, even if there's a crisis, even if Mr. Liberal Blogger is scared, it's still a crime for Dick Cheney to torture people. Simple as that. Simple as that. Now I feel bad because I'm sitting here talking bad about this stupid liberal blogger and I'm not naming him. So let me see if I can pull up Glenn Greenwald's blog real quick and name the idiot that I'm making fun of here by name. Let's see here. It was, who is this idiot, man? Where is this idiot? I'm going to find it. Oh, Ross Douthat at The Atlantic. D-O-U-T-H-A-T. Well, Ross, I suggest you torture yourself to death if you really think that your carte blanche somehow diffuses the responsibility away from Dick Cheney and George Bush for the kidnappings and tortures and murders that they have committed. If you're so sure that you bear part of the responsibility, rather than seeing that as a method for acquitting them, how about you just convict yourself, Ross? Dumbass. Oh, gee, and I ought to find the quote here. Where's this great quote? I didn't get what I wanted from this administration, but I think you could say with some justification that I got what I asked for. Yeah, well, some of us didn't ask for it, Ross. Some of us knew that the laws of war applied during wartime before Rumsfeld ever issued a single torture order. Some of us, before the towers even fell all the way to the ground, knew that government was going to use this as an excuse to do whatever they wanted and that that was not okay. So maybe you're a big crybaby, Ross, whose emotions just completely conquered and thwarted your cerebral cortex from firing, but that's your problem. And if you really share in the responsibility of Bush and Cheney and their torture regime, fine, accept your responsibility. But no, the fact that you were in on it, at least in spirit, does not acquit the people who ordered these actions in violation of the law at all. I don't care if you and your mom and everyone in your whole neighborhood was really, really scared of Al-Qaeda. That doesn't mean anything. You might as well tell me in second grade you were good at soccer. It's completely irrelevant. Has nothing to do with it. Ross, if you're so sure that you are partially responsible for the kidnapping, the torture, the murder, the aggressive warfare, why then by all means kill yourself. By all means, lock yourself in a filthy government cage for the rest of your life. But how dare you write that somehow Bush and Cheney ought to not be held responsible? Just because you fell for their bullshit. Liberals. Oh, liberals. There's going to be, you know, if we're lucky, 8 years. If we're lucky, you know, Obama won't just be the emperor for life by the time 8 years is up. And man, I gotta tell you, I am not looking forward to the Obama era. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, these liberals with their tortured justifications. You know, at least conservatives have the excuse that they're completely illiterate and have no idea what you're talking about. But liberals ostensibly, you know, believe that there's such a thing as reason. And even that humans have the ability to use reason in order to analyze facts and conclude things. So what's their excuse for being so pathetic and so stupid and so willing to defer to the authority of Dick Cheney to kidnap and torture and murder people? And now to start this Obama era off saying, oh, gee, well, you know, I don't know, guys, because, you know, it was a crime and everything. And I know that there's a law against, you know, murdering people and stuff like that. But I kind of wanted him to do it. See? So maybe they should be allowed to get away with it. What the fuck? The Atlantic. The liberals. Oh, my God. This is how I felt in 2001. It went something like this. I just don't know if I can do it anymore. I spent the whole Clinton years hating this guy every single day and hating every single one of his employees and every murder that they committed and a few tortures here and there. And then with Bush and Cheney coming in, oh my God, who's got the ability to keep track of these guys? And whoever the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy is in their administration, I just don't know if I can do it. Well, okay, I did it. I had to. And now here I am facing a whole other same thing again. And just like I've continued to call for Bill Clinton's conviction for his war crimes of the 1990s, I'm going to have to continue to call for all the criminal convictions for war crimes of the Bush administration, you know, all the way through the Obama era, because, of course, none of them will be held criminally responsible. So you think I'm a broken record on Oklahoma City? Well, just wait to, you know, 5 years from now when I'm talking about the lies that they used to get us into war in Iraq. And the murders committed by CIA and military employees of prisoners in United States custody. It's getting to be a heavy load, man. I don't know whether I can deal. Okay, yeah, I can. Still, it pisses me off, though. All right, God, it's already 10 till, huh? Incredible. All right, here, I got to play y'all some tunes. I want to hear some tunes. It's anti-war radio on Chaos in Austin, Texas. Here's some Black Flag, and we'll be back. Ah, fuck, man. I wasn't even paying attention. Look how quiet it's coming out. I'm starting this whole song over again, dude. Jesus Christ. Here's some Black Flag as it's meant to be heard. Loud. Flag for you. Sorry I came out so quiet there at first, man. I ran to go reheat this cold coffee. God dang it. All right. Well, hell, you know what? I think I'm going to let this next song play, only quiet-like. I like this. This is the Beastie Boys, Ricky's theme. I'm not sure who Ricky is. For some reason, this song reminds me of riding down Anderson Lane in my old Chevy with my buddy Devin in the pouring-ass rain. Years ago. Alright, it's been a while since I did this one, so I'll try to make it brief. You guys recognize that the U.S. government has lied the people of this land into every major war in our entire history, beginning with the War of 1812 to 14, which was simply a cynical, aggressive attempt to steal Canada at gunpoint. An attempt to march in and take Canada from Britain by force. Oh, yeah, conscripting our sailors on the high seas, this, that. Yeah, that was a pretext for war. That's why all the Yankees, all the Federalists, called it Mr. Madison's War. A war of choice. An aggressive war by the Republicans. An attempt, a blatant attempt, to simply invade and conquer and steal Canada. The next major war was against Mexico, which President Polk pretended had attacked American soldiers on American soil, when in fact they were defending themselves from American soldiers on Mexican soil, at least disputed soil between the San Jacinto and the Rio Grande. And President Polk knew it, and Abraham Lincoln, the congressman from Illinois, called him out for it at the time. This is, of course, why historians place Polk as one of the greatest presidents, because he lied this country into war. That's what makes him great, if you ask a government court historian, a university court historian. Of course, the next major conflict was the Civil War, which was which they still lie about to this day and pretend was had anything to do with freeing the slaves who were held in the South, when in fact it was an invasion to prevent the tax from going away. Basically, the Federalists, Abraham Lincoln, who had denounced Polk for his aggressive warfare, decided that if the South left and he could no longer collect all the protective tariffs from their imports of finished goods from Europe, then he wouldn't have the money he needed to build a railroad to California. And so he murdered 600,000 people to collect taxes. It's as simple as that. He conquered. The North conquered the South. It wasn't a civil war at all. A civil war would imply that, what, the five or six Gulf states that originally broke off were trying to, what, conquer Washington, D.C.? Virginia and North Carolina and Kentucky and Tennessee and, I forget. Many of the southern states did not even secede from the Union until after Lincoln had mandated that they turn their militias over to his Grand Army of the Republic for use against Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana. When he said, I'm going to march troops across your Tennessee, they said, no, you're not. Remember that from fifth grade? That was five or six states, I forget now, that seceded from the Union, that the rest only seceded after Lincoln promised to invade through their territory, and had nothing to do with freeing black slaves, which was only decided on 2 years into the war and was only a public relations stunt to keep the French and the British from supplying the Confederacy, because it would make it too politically incorrect back home for them to be on the side of a battle over slavery. Simple as that. And of course, the whole battle at Fort Sumter was a big provocation. Fort Sumter, South Carolina had seceded from the Union. What right did the national government have to keep a tax collection fort in their bay? None. And of course, the Southerners were stupid enough, I forgot who was the guy who gave the order, to fire on Fort Sumter, which didn't result in any federal casualties, but provided the pretext for war. And made the South the guys who started it. And, of course, the Indian Wars. How about this for a lie? God gave all this land to us, and these brutal, savage, less-than-human people are in our way, and so therefore it's perfectly okay to murder them all and steal all their shit. How's that for a lie? They didn't have to get much more sophisticated than that. I guess they could cite a particular massacre here or there and say, look what these Indians did. We're only retaliating, right? Like Israel and Gaza. Oh, we're protecting ourselves from, aggression on the part of the Palestinians. Oh yeah, those Indians, they're terrible. Did you hear about the terrible massacre that they committed? Right, so now our invasion and conquering of the entire West, that's how to bring the North and the South back together again, is send their newly reunified army west to kill the last of the natives. And, you know, they didn't need any specific real pretext besides just pretending, of course, that the Indians were less than human and perfectly okay to murder. Oh, and that's what Jesus wanted with his manifest destiny. It's funny because I'm not really fluent in every, you know, chapter and verse of the Bible, but does it really say in there that someday people of the old world will discover a new continent on the other side of the ocean, and when they get there, they ought to murder all the red men and steal their land? Yeah. All right. So the next major war after that was against Spain, a cynical attempt by President McKinley to steal Cuba and the Philippines and Puerto Rico from Spain, pretended that he was fighting for Cuban independence. It was just, you know, the Monroe Doctrine kind of thing. Spain, get out of the Western Hemisphere. Or, well, this side of the ocean. But no, it was just a cynical attempt to steal Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. And, of course, the Philippine War ended up killing hundreds of thousands of people there who thought for some reason that, wonderful, now that the Spanish Armada is leaving, that they could be free again, and until they realized the red, white, and blue on the horizon meant battleships, as we were simply coming to replace Spain. And then Woodrow Wilson did everything he could to lie us into World War One. I don't even know what his excuses were for in invading Mexico and Bolivia and other places like that during the early part of his presidency, but in order to get us into World War One, he lied and pretended that the Lusitania was not a ship full of munitions when it was sunk by German U-boats. And he lied to Congress and pretended that the Zimmerman telegram purported to be a real threat, that Germany, which could not even get any of their ships out of their harbor, I guess a U-boat or two, but Germany, whose navy was completely blockaded by the British, was somehow going to help Mexico reconquer the southwest of the United States. That was the pretext for American entry into World War One. And of course, as Robert Stinnett has proven in his book Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor, 1999, the greatest treason in the history of all mankind was resorted to by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in order to get the American people, who at the time were better than 80% opposed to intervening in the war in Europe, to in fact intervene in the war in Europe by getting their children murdered, 3,500 of their young adult children murdered, blown apart with high explosives and drowned in the salt water of the Pacific Ocean, so that they would have a pretext to go help Stalin. I mean, it's not like Germany was about to invade England across the Channel or anything. They had no navy. Hitler had no navy. The British had a hell of a one. So, you know, I don't know who FDR was going to help other than his buddy, Uncle Joe Stalin, who, of course, was the direct employer of FDR's right-hand man, Harry Hopkins, and Harry Dexter White as well. As Carol Quigley writes in Tragedy and Hope, Harry Truman knew that Harry Dexter White was an actual KGB agent, not a communist, you know, went to a meeting one time, but an actual KGB agent before he sent him to go and write up the Bretton Woods agreement to transfer all of America's gold out of the country in exchange for almost nothing. But anyway, so there, yeah, there was World War II. Now, the lie in Korea was, you know, I don't know what, that Truman can do whatever he wants. And the American people ended up hating Harry Truman for what he'd done and getting them into the war in Korea. Of course, they lied about the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. Simply, it was a new man on the sonar machine. And the Navy figured it out that afternoon that, like, wait a minute, this guy's calling a false positive every 10 seconds. We have not successfully dodged 50 torpedoes today. You know, wake up our senior sonar man and get him in here and put the headphones on him. Oh, dumbass, the new guy is reporting our own propeller as the sound of torpedoes coming this way. Good job. And Lyndon Johnson knew that. The whole story is told in Chapter 1 of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg. And they lied and pretended that the North Vietnamese had aggressed against American boats in international waters in order to escalate that war. And, of course, the whole Cold War was premised on a lie that Uncle Joe Stalin's Soviet Union that had just lost, what, 30 million people or 20 million people in the war against the Nazis were somehow on the verge of conquering the whole world if we didn't stop them. And, of course, you know, deliberately abandoning all of America's war material and really forcing Chiang Kai-shek to abandon all of his war material where Mao could get to it and handing that largest, most populous nation on earth over to communism. And, well, primarily just by forcing the Japanese out, leaving all their equipment behind as well. Certainly helped the case. The propaganda case that the communists were going to conquer the whole world and were actually a threat to the United States of America, which, of course, they never were. And then, of course, there are a bunch of, you know, Manuel Noriega is not a employee of George Bush, you know, as they invaded there. That's about all the lie you need for that. And, of course, Saddam Hussein was invited by James Baker to invade Kuwait. He was told, we are not interested in your dispute with Kuwait. We're not, we don't get involved in Arab-Arab affairs. And go right ahead. You have a green light, Mr. Hussein, to invade Kuwait. And apparently he went too far and ended up taking the whole country when he was supposed to only take the northern oil fields in order to, you know, break the Kuwaitis' kneecaps, not kill them. And, geez, I know I'm skipping a lot. You have the whole secret war in Afghanistan, not-so-secret war in Afghanistan in the 80s, and, of course, all the Central America policy and the overthrow of democratically elected governments in Guatemala and Chile and Iran and all over the world. And September 11th, at least they lied about the motivation of the people who did it and explained it as a provocation, a cutting edge of some Islamo-fascist caliphate vanguard coming for us, announcing their arrival on Earth, when in fact they're nothing but a reaction, an insurgency against our empire that already exists in their part of the world. Simple as that. And then, of course, that was used as a pretext to underlie the policy of regime change. That we must modernize and remake and democratize the Middle East so people won't want to be terrorists anymore. Because, of course, that's why they hate us, because of the countries where we don't support the dictatorships there, they want us to, I guess. And so Iraq, Iran, and Syria, particularly three countries that had not even a single citizen involved in the 9/11 attacks in any way whatsoever, were targeted for regime change. While, of course, Lebanon, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, the countries where all the terrorists come from, countries where their dictatorships are backed by the United States of America, are not to be democratized, in fact, but are to stay dictatorships. Big surprise there. And you know, who knows if they'll even have to try to come up with a lie to escalate the war in Afghanistan and get it into Pakistan. I guess Osama and Ayman al-Zawahiri's presumed presence in that country is enough of a pretext for Barack Obama to spread the war there. But it, you know, seems like since they do nothing but lie us into war all the time, that probably the next time they try to get us into a war, that will be a bunch of lies that they're telling us that time too. Such as, for example, Iran is making nuclear weapons, even though anyone with 3 minutes and a Google machine can debunk that lie. You know, they would still have us believe that in order to try to justify war against Iran. And of course, you know, we talked about that the Obama war guarantee. This was Charles Krauthammer's idea. He switched out John Kennedy's phrase from the Cuban Missile Crisis. Any attack by Cuba on the United States will be considered an attack by the Soviet Union, and we will retaliate against Moscow if Cuba does anything, was basically the line. And Krauthammer said, no, you know what it should be, or in this circumstance, it should be, any attack by Iran against Israel will be considered an attack by Iran against the United States. And we'll respond in kind to that. And, oh hell, you know, while I'm at it, I might as well find that, Norman Podhoretz quote, shouldn't I? I think I should find it. Let's see if I can find the Norman Podhoretz quote. Here it is. It's my favorite Norman Podhoretz quote, actually. This is Anti-War Radio. We'll be right back.
Well, if we were to bomb the Iranians, as I hope and pray we will, it will unleash a wave of anti-Americanism all over the world that will make the anti-Americanism we've experienced so far look like a love fest. On the other hand, excuse me, that's a worst-case scenario.
In a time when we're spending billions of dollars in a war to control oil in Iraq, 3,000 soldiers have come home in coffins. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians have lost their lives. Our brothers and sisters in New Orleans are left homeless and hungry. They murdered Sean Bell. They murdered Amadou Diallo. They murdered Timothy Stansbury. And it's time to say, no more! No more! No more! No more! No more!
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket. Hit a drummer, get wicked. The crew, the view, the push, the back, the black attack. So I sat and tapped and smacked the Mac. Now I'm ready to mic it. Hear my favoritism, Rolo. Never be a brother like me, go solo. Blazer and a stage of major. Ways to blaze your brain and train ya. The way I'm living, forgiving what I'm giving up. X on the flex, hear me now. I don't know about later. As for now, I know how to avoid the paranoid. Man, I've had it up to here. Yeah, how weird got him going in fear. Rhetoric said and read just a bit ago. Not quitting the sign of hard rhymer. Work to keep from getting jerk changes some ways. So way back in the better days. Raw, metaphysically bold. Never follow the code. Still drop the load. Never question what I am. God knows. Cause it's coming from the heart. What I got, better get some. Hustler of culture. Stick bitten, been spit in the face. But the rhymes keep fitting. Respect's been given. How'd you living? Now I can't protect the pad or the defect. Check the record of wrecking. International wreck. Played office of intellect. Made the call, took the fall, broke the laws. Not my fault that they've fallen off. Known as fair square throughout my years. So I growl at the living fire. Black to the bone, my home is your home. So welcome to the Terror Dome. There's a hole in an apple has been rotten. Steam like the clan, I'm playing like Bin Laden. Scream, scream, batter, slick, strip editor. Drop the LP and he hit like Hezbollah. 7 years later, it's the year to God. United States government is just a facade. The Catholic Church got charged with the mob. I see it all like the Wizard of Oz. It is a yellow brick road to fame, which is in cause. If you only had a brain, you would know who you are. Poison your ventilation, cut your education. Secret information, world domination. Take over reservation, trigger the NHs in the ocean. Cause tsunamis to control the population. Eyes in the sky, hit an observation. If you're over 65, I take away your medication. Like, give me that, go to war, press rewind. I just wanna get mad, I put it down on the pad. Give you something that you never had. Controlling, feet of high rolling. God bless your soul and keep living. Black to the bone, my home is your home. Well, welcome to the Terror Dome.
That's right, it's Chaos Radio in Austin. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks for listening to the show. We got a great interview with Patrick Coburn coming up. Well, I don't know how great it'll be, but I assume it'll be great. And if you've ever heard Patrick Coburn on this show, then I guess you probably expect it'll be a hell of a good interview, too. Well, that's my take on it. I want to make sure that you guys have had a chance at least to hear me tell you that you got to make sure to read this thing. I can't really boss people around, but I like suggesting stuff. And I would like it very much if you would read the Senate Armed Services Committee's declassified executive summary of their report, their inquiry into the treatment of detainees in U.S. custody. It's available at Senator Carl Levin's website. If you type into your Google Senate Armed Services Committee detainees.pdf. You'll find it. Find it. Read it. Now, there's really nothing in there that you didn't already know if you've read Chain of Command by Seymour Hersh or Tortured Team by Philip Sands or, hell, just kept track of this show and listened over the years. But, well, anyway, it's all official. It's all official, so, you know, read it. It's important. And also, I want to point out, my friend Lenny has turned me on to this website, Black Agenda Report, the Journal of African American Political Thought and Action. And I'm not too sure, I guess, you know, I have to assume that the guys sort of lean left or something, I don't really know. But all I've read here is not about economics or anything, it's only about American foreign policy that I've seen so far. The man's name is Glenn Ford. And he's got an article today called U.S. Proposes International Gang Rape of Somalia. And you know what I like? I like it when Americans have clear eyes about American Somalia policy. Gang rape is wrong, even when nation states do it. I know, even if they have a yellow ribbon and an American flag, I know it's hard to accept. And of course, gang rape is not just, you know, an alliteration or something when you're talking about Somalia. That's been what's happened there for the last 2 years. Murder, rendition, kidnapping, torture, and widespread rape, along with starvation, 700,000 refugees, 1.5 million people on the brink of death at any given day due to the complete and total breakdown of the division of labor in their society. And all because this country, America, you know, Statue of Liberty and yellow ribbons and all that, hired the Ethiopian former communist, now fascist dictatorship, which is, you know, has their own ethnic cleansing things going on in their own home country, had them invade Somalia and destroy it for us. In according to the Washington Post, according to American Pravda, in order to arrest 3 Al-Qaeda suspects wanted for questioning by the FBI. 3 men who hadn't even been indicted, but supposedly had something or other to do with the bombings of the African embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, 1998. And so for that, we've destroyed that country, and now that the Ethiopian government and military has been humiliated and defeated and are withdrawing, they need another excuse to invade. And that's the pirates. And the UN has pushed through the UN Security Council authorization for any country, apparently, to just invade Somalia and do whatever they want in the name of stopping pirates. You know, as though this was 1810 or whatever, and we were dealing with the Barbary pirates who had a little military fort out on the end of the peninsula instead of just a bunch of individual people who are all intermingled with the rest of whoever else still lives in Mogadishu, and are indecipherable by looking at them from the average citizen there. As my friend Shauna was pointing out, they're talking about using sonic weapons to keep the pirates away. Because, oh, we want to use non-lethal weapons to keep the pirates away from the ships. But then they want to invite any country, any navy in the world, any Marine Corps in the world to go ashore in Somalia and kill people in the name of stopping the pirates. No, don't kill the ones who are actually out at sea pirating. Oh no, we should like figure out some kind of sonic weapon we can shoot at them that won't kill them. And then we ought to just, I don't know, I guess bombard Mogadishu with our 40-inch guns. Go figure, that's, you know, U.S. and U.N. logic. In problem solving and what do they call it? Peacekeeping for you there. But what do you care about a bunch of Somalians anyway? I guess nothing, right? It's Anti-War Radio. We'll be right back.
I used
Y'all, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. It's Chaos in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide on the internet at chaosradioaustin.org and at antiwar.com/radio. And I want to point you guys to a couple of two or three articles here. Total defeat for U.S. in Iraq at counterpunch.org. Also, each shoe was worth 1,000 words. And also, the latest one for the Independent in the United Kingdom, keep out, a message for foreign leaders. It's Patrick Coburn. He's the best Western reporter covering the Iraq war this entire time. He's the author of the book Muqtada. Welcome back to the show, Patrick.
Glad to be back.
I'm very happy to have you here. Now let's get right to this total defeat for the U.S. in Iraq. I have to tell you, I've been watching the news lately, reading the news and seeing Ray Odierno, for example, saying that, whatever the SOFA status of forces agreement says, we're going to do whatever we want. And if it says we have to leave the Iraqi cities by a certain date, we don't have to. And if they say we have to be out of the country by 2011, well, don't worry. That's a long time from now. We can renegotiate and so forth like that. And yet it seems your take in this article, which admittedly is from the 11th, so I don't know what your opinion is today, but as of this writing, you seem to think that this status of forces agreement really spells the end of the American occupation of Iraq.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think there's no question of this. You know, the Iraqis read it that way. I remember one very significant thing about this agreement, that the Iranians went along with it. It wouldn't have passed without Iranian agreement.
Right.
Now, the Iranians, above all, are keen to get the U.S. out of Iraq. If they thought the U.S. was going to stay, they wouldn't have backed this agreement.
Now, how keen are they on getting rid of us? Because, of course, this is something we've talked about over the last couple of years, at least with you and really this whole time, is the question of America installing the Dawa Party and Supreme Islamic Council, which are backed by Iran but otherwise have seemed to be very weak. And so when Bush says, you know, as they stand up, we'll stand down, that kind of thing, they've needed us. Our guys can't stand down because the Maliki government would fall, or at least it seemed that way for much of this time.
I mean, that was true in the past. I think Maliki probably now thinks he can survive, or at least his government can survive. He can also see, you see, with elections come up, in the provincial elections come up in January, and we have parliamentary elections later in the year. And one of the crucial things that happened when this agreement was being negotiated, the Status of Forces Agreement between Iraq and the U.S., was that none of the parties, political parties, dared do anything except demand the U.S. get out, because they knew they were facing election. If they did anything else, they wouldn't, they'd lose a lot of votes. So that was a sort of continual pressure, and it's going to go on being a pressure. So I think, you know, one of the things that astonishes me is that this agreement hasn't had attracted more attention in the rest of the world. After all, this is, the war in Iraq has been, shaped the political landscape of our time. But this agreement seems to have been buried, I guess, because it was agreed, you know, just at the time that the Obama administration was being formed, when we have the financial crisis, so people didn't really notice it. But this is, a critical event in the politics of our age.
Mm-hmm. And so, well, I'm trying to get a handle on this, really. I guess the bottom line is that if the Maliki government, which is really made up of most of the leadership of the biggest Shiite parties, if they insist we leave, we really have to leave. I'm sorry to use we so liberally here. If the U.S.
Sure, yeah.
government, if the Shiites say get out, that's it. We can't start the war over again against the Shiites.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. had trouble enough fighting the Sunni Arabs, who are only 20% of the population. They can't stay if they're opposed by the Shia as well. And that's always been true, and is true today. Also, there's Iraqi armed forces are pretty big these days. Will they, how far will they cooperate with the U.S.? Then there's talk of, the Iraqi armed forces are not completely trained, but at the moment they're not really in the business of fighting anybody. The Shia militias were stood down by the Iranians earlier this year, the militias of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army, and the Sunni have allied themselves with the U.S. for the moment. So there's an awful lot of violence in Iraq, but the Iraqi army isn't going to have to fight a great big war.
So when the American generals are making these statements that, yeah, we had to sign a piece of paper so we could stay, but it doesn't matter what the details are, et cetera, they're basically just fooling themselves. They're in a position, whether they realize it or not, where they really do have to get out by 2011, period.
Yeah, you can see this. And I mean, another point, Scott, is, look at the reaction in Iraq. Look at the reaction in the Muslim world to the shoe-throwing at President Bush earlier this week.
Indeed. Let's talk about that.
I have a guy who throws shoes.
I have a headline here that says that the Turkish maker of the shoe has, this is the most popular shoe in the Muslim world now, apparently, the company that makes this particular brand, model of shoe that was thrown.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's, you can imagine the expression on the face of the maker when he heard what use his shoe has been put to, and I guess they've been churning them out ever since. But this, you know, the reaction in Iraq of suddenly you have demonstrations in favor of this young Shia journalist, not just in Shia areas of Iraq, but, you know, in Sunni strongholds like Fallujah and Tikrit and Mosul. It's rather amazing that you have a cross-the-board support for this young guy. And that sort of shows the general attitude towards the U.S. presence, the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Somehow the Odierno doesn't be named, and the others don't seem to be able to take this on board. I get the impression that, you know, when Petraeus had a fairly acute, General Petraeus, a fairly acute sense of Iraqi politics, I don't think the successors have are smart about this. But there's no doubt, you know, in my mind that what it says in this agreement is going to happen, that U.S. forces are going to be out of the cities and towns and villages by next by summer 2009, and the U.S. forces are going to be out of Iraq in 2011. And if they aren't, there'll be a sort of tremendous row. This isn't something that can be blurred.
Right. Well, I sure hope you're right. I've wanted an end to this war since before it began, and I certainly would love to see it. Although I have to admit, I'm pessimistic. I do understand your point that if the Dawah Party, the Mahdi Army, the Supreme Islamic Council, and all these Shiite factions are agreed that it's time to kick America out, that may be a force that really cannot be dealt with by the American Army, such as it's constituted in Iraq at that point. And yet, it seems like the establishment here in America is determined to hold on to this country, to keep some permanent bases, to stay forever, no matter what, hell or high water. I dare say they might even be willing to risk a massive, widespread Shia uprising and restarting the war in order to stay.
Yeah, but you see, they also have to deal with the Iraqi army and police these days. You know, it's very difficult to operate without their cooperation. And it's dubious if they'd get it. You know, it's also always been true in Iraq that if Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani said the occupation is going to end, then the occupation is going to end. I mean, this is somebody whose instructions are followed by, you know, not just laborers in the markets, but generals commanding the army. So you know, whatever happens, I think that there's no way of avoiding an end to the occupation. So I think that this idea, you know, there's an idea sort of on the far right that somehow doesn't much matter what these guys in Iraq say, though you would have thought one of the lessons of the whole Iraqi occupation of the whole last 6 years is that it really does matter what Iraqis think and what Iraqis do. And then I think there's a fear on the left and among opponents of the war that somehow this is one more con, that this is one more spurious turning point and nothing much is going to really happen. But I think that's wrong. I think that's over-cynical. I think that this is really going to happen now.
Hmm. Oh, wow, yeah. Well, I'm not sure. I guess I'm thinking of, like, the lies, the different lies that they've used, the various turning points. But, you know, the theme is that everything now is basically the eye of the storm. And, of course, we've talked before about, boy, you know, you call the surge working. There are still millions of refugees who are afraid to come home. There's still widespread violence that makes Iraq one of the most, if not the most, violent place on earth right now. The surge only worked compared to the absolute slaughter of 2006 and 2007. And yet, you know, when the lie then, the spin then, was that we can't leave now in the middle of this terrible crisis. We have to see this through till things are okay. Now they say things are okay, but we can't leave because then everything might fall apart. And in a sense, that seems kind of right, and doesn't it, in the sense that, like, the former Sunni insurgency that they now call the Sons of Iraq are at peace because they're being paid to be at peace and to bide their time and rearm and prepare for the next battle of Baghdad, I guess, right?
I don't think so, no. I think, you know, the Sunni were pretty heavily defeated. There may be some who think that way, but I doubt if it's going to happen. Unless... You know, that if you begin to have sectarian violence, let's say you have a really big bomb in some Shia shrine or marketplace, as you start having thousands of people killed again, then you have tit-for-tat killings by the Shia on the Sunni, that you have government troops, you know, slaughtering people and so forth, then it might all start over again, but it hasn't happened yet. I mean, it's pretty violent, but it's not at the sort of butcheries that we had before. Also, bear in mind, there is quite sort of, you know, one of the strange things about Iraq is the communities there, Kurds, Shia, Sunni, often hate each other, but at the same time, there's quite strong Iraqi nationalism. They kind of really do want the U.S. out. And so things may... just continue as they are on the present level of fairly high violence, but not a complete explosion.
Mm-hmm. So you think that there's a chance that the, for example, the Dawa Party and the leaders of the Sons of Iraq can come basically to a gentleman's agreement that, listen, you provide security in your area, we'll provide security in ours and not fight?
Yeah, I mean, it could happen or that way. It depends how smart the government is. They come into Sunni areas. You know, people were saying to me, you know, in one area the government came in some interior ministry troops. They arrested 24 people. They released half of them. But the half who were released had all been beaten up, had broken limbs and so forth. You know, if there's a lot of that, then there's going to be a Sunni reaction. But that hasn't happened everywhere since.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess back to the story of the famous shoe thrower who will go down in the history of the world from now on. It's one of those events, and we have seen a few of these different ones from when Joe Biden passed his bill in the Senate saying we ought to divide Iraq in three after the Blackwater massacre. Around the same time, we've seen these kind of outbursts here and there, at least, of Iraqis coming together with this kind of nationalist, you know, occupier out sort of thing, maybe remembering from time to time that their differences with us are much more than their differences with each other.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the two things I think go together. You know, the... I think, you know, U.S. leverage in Iraq is going down. You know, it's as the troops withdraw, it'll go down further. It's still a very, you know, it's still a very dangerous place. I mean, and also a pretty miserable place. I keep on being told it's better, you know. But usually I find I sort of sometimes appear on radio programs and there's somebody in the green zone saying how great it is and restaurants are open and ice cream parlors are open. And but these guys never leave the green zone. Or if they do, it's always with, you know, a couple of dozen heavily armed bodyguards.
So, pardon me. The stories where they're saying restaurants are again open, even that is still, when they're trying to make that comparison, you know, these restaurants were closed before and now are open, they're still talking within the green zone wall?
Oh, sure, yeah, these guys, and often, you know, you see television of somebody walking down the street, the correspondent walking down the street, but generally, you know, there are a couple of armed guards with the cameraman that you don't see. But these other guys who are talking about, you know, the restaurants being open, generally they're within the green zone. They don't go there. I do go out to restaurants, you know. I mean, not many, but I'm very careful. And it's not exactly the what everybody's doing in Baghdad. you know, there's a little bit more life around, but there are some areas that restaurants are open, but other areas, the whole west half of Baghdad, people, things really start closing up at 7 in the evening.
When was the last time you were there?
I was there about just over a month ago.
Just over a month ago. And when you go there, and I think this is a measure of the violence, how many other journalists are willing to get in the back of a car and ride all around Iraq to the most dangerous places as you're willing to do?
There are people who do it. I mean, Scott, I think it works this way. I think that there are good print journalists, you know, for instance, McClatchy, what used to be Knight Ridder. They're very mm-hmm. good. There are other people. Good print journalists, very brave, go out and do things. Television, there are good journalists, but very little makes it onto the air, according to what they tell me. I mean, you see television over there. Do you see much about Iraq at the moment or over the last 6 months?
Oh, certainly not. Everything is, you know, just electoral politics and gossip and nonsense on TV.
Yeah, I mean, one of the networks there that has an operation that I'm told has an annual budget of $20 million, and the guys there were complaining they hadn't been on air for 50 consecutive days. So that, you know, it's kind of disappeared from television. I think you still, you know, if you go to the internet and you pick out the best journalists, you can find people who go out and begin to get a picture of Iraq. I think, you know, let's talk generally for a moment about the coverage of Iraq. I think the correspondents there have often done quite a good job. You know, where it really falls down is when you have the talking heads in Washington, you know, saying what's happening, and retired generals and so forth. And then you get this undiluted propaganda mixed with almost total ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
People from the think tanks who are introduced as experts, former military officers, presented as if they were neutral observers. I think that's really been the one of the major failings of the media over the last 6 years.
Yeah, well, and especially, you know, over the last two, it's been the silence. It's been the lie by omission, where they simply say, well, everybody know that the surge is working, or everybody knows that the surge has worked, and so it's over. You know, Mara Liasson, who is supposedly this liberal news person from NPR News, but who also does Fox News Sunday Morning and so forth, commented the other day that the Iraq War is pretty much won, and George Bush is handing Barack Obama a very, you know, stable and wonderful Iraq, and everything's great now. That George Bush, in fact, as people look back, they will be very forgiving of his Iraq War policy, because, after all, it worked out just fine.
Yeah, it's kind of self-deception, and helped, as you say, by the fact, you know, that it sort of disappeared from the airwaves. I mean, one of the sort of curious things is that the people who say this to me, and, you know, I live in a hotel which is outside the Green Zone, and I sometimes say to them, well, come right over, come and see me, you know, I'm not actually that far from the Green Zone, you know. And either they say they won't turn up, or they turn up with lots of armed bodyguards. You know, so has it changed a little? Yeah, but, you know, not by that much. You know, again, that there are things which aren't, I think, make very little news, like, you know, that this new States of the Forces Agreement, as I just mentioned, which is presented, if it's presented as a great military victory, how come, you know, the main support for it is the Iranian government, perhaps not that friendly to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The decisive moment in this agreement being passed was the ministers that belonged to the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which is the largest Shia party, got a telephone call from their leader saying, okay, guys, we now support this new agreement. And the leader was in Tehran. He'd just been told what the line was.
That's Abdulaziz al-Hakim?
Yeah.
And he was in Tehran at the time he made the phone call.
He was in Tehran, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, let me ask you this. Is there any kind of negotiation, or was there any negotiation about this agreement between somebody like Adorno and Petraeus and the Iranians?
Well, it was the agreement they kept on Maliki sort of discovered earlier this year that the more nationalist line he took, saying he wanted the U.S. out of it. Originally in March, this seemed to be just a continue. When this negotiation started, it seemed that the on the States of the Forces Agreement, the U.S. side seemed to simply want the occupation to be continued as it had been under the UN, United Nations mandate, with no real change.
Sure, 58 bases
no
and all that.
There was no timescale at that stage for any withdrawal. That was wholly against U.S. policy. This was rejected, strongly rejected by the Iraqi side, and Maliki continually refused to sign. Then eventually the U.S. agreed to a timescale for withdrawal. Originally this was meant to be conditional on security. What eventually they signed wasn't conditional at all, that they're going to be out by certain dates. And only then, that it only that was when it got through the Iraqi parliament. But it's, you know, it's a complete transformation from what the U.S. wanted 9 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the aspect of the Iraq war that I think gets the least coverage of all is the situation up in Kurdistan. And it, I guess, mostly just sort of goes understood that, oh, everything's fine up there and they love us up there and et cetera like that. There really is a lot of violence up there in Kurdistan. And I've had various expert guests on the show over the years describe especially the city of Kirkuk as a powder keg or a pile of oily rags or, a tinder box or something that's about to catch on fire, you know, this whole time. I wonder if you can kind of update us on what it's like up there now.
You know, one of the problems about Iraq is that people just could, you know, that events happen, violence happens. If it happened anywhere else in the world, this would be, you know, get a lot of coverage. But, you know, just outside Kirkuk, there was a bomb in a restaurant, you know, last week. You know, that killed, I think, around 40-plus people, you know, it hardly gets noticed outside Iraq. Somehow this no longer makes news. You have, you know, there's a dividing line between the Kurds and the Arabs in Iraq, which goes through Kirkuk, which the Kurds claim, but is also in Mosul, which is the third biggest city in Iraq, and right down to the border at a place called Kanakin. You know, there's been continual fighting. Kirkuk itself, which is, you know, a terrible dump compared to, I mean, even compared to other parts of Iraq, there's no settlement there. And there's been sort of continual fighting. Mosul itself, most of the Kurds have fled from one part of the city. Remains extremely violent. In some senses, in Iraq, the divisions, the hostility between the Shia and Sunni Arabs has gone down, but the hostility between the Arabs in general and the Kurds has gone up.
Well, and that is extremely important for the future of the entire region, right? The relationship between, the kind of difference between Iraqi nationalism holding these groups together, you know, like we see during the shoe throwing and all that, versus Kurdish nationalism, which, of course, you know, I'm value neutral on it, whose side to take or whatever, but it seems like if there ever really is an independent Kurdistan, which is one option here, then that means pieces of Syria and Turkey and Iran are in play and much further, you know, chances for major conflict down the road from here.
Yeah, I mean, it could happen that way, but if the Kurds are smart in northern Iraq, they'll kind of play that down because they don't want to take on, you know, they don't want to frighten the governments of neighboring countries that have got Kurdish minorities to the point that they're prepared to fight a war. You know, for the first time, the Kurds are on the verge of having something pretty close to an independent country. I mean, they're an autonomous region in Iraq, but it's very close to an independent country. That's the first time the Kurds have had it. So the smart things from their point of view is to try and consolidate that and not to really rile the Turks or the Syrians or the Iranians.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but there's still a lot of friction in that area.
Well, and in recent months, the Turks have bombed the mountains there. I don't know if they've actually been effective at getting any of their enemies, but has that ceased over the past few months? Or
Yeah, they keep on doing that. It's one of those sort of types of violence that somehow gets accepted by people. You know, it runs on the Reuters and AP wires, but nobody really pays much attention.
Now, right, two of America's allies at war against each other.
Sorry?
I said, yeah, two of America's allies at war against each other, and it gets a little nothing headline.
Yeah, I mean, they're attacking up in the mountains or along the Iranian border and along the border with Turkey. You know, this is very sort of rugged terrain, deep canyons, not quite sure what they're hitting. I mean, there aren't too many people living there, and with the bombing, there are even less. You know, people move, particularly this time of year, people tend to move down to the cities because of the snow. I mean, it's an area I used to know quite well. Not sure I'm too keen on visiting it at the moment because the Turks are mainly hitting the roads, and there aren't too many of them. They're mainly tracks. So, this has somehow become a sort of accepted part of the local scene that every so often accepted that, say, in Baghdad, not by local people, who are mostly sort of herdsmen and shepherds, that Turkish aircraft come over and bomb the hell out of the place.
All right, now, before I let you go, is there any good question I should have asked you? Is something you'd like to address that I might not have thought of?
I mean, I think that, I don't know, somehow, you know, it's a very sort of strange thing about Iraq that before the U.S. invaded, I don't think there was much knowledge of what was happening in Iraq. And now that the U.S. is departing, I think somehow there isn't much knowledge of what's happening here. I mean, there's this strange belief that the surge succeeded, which, you know, just is demonstrably not so. I mean, what happened was really to do with other factors of the Sunni being defeated by the Shia, of Iranian support for the present government, and also a belief that somehow Iraq is at peace, despite the fact, I mean, this is contradicted not just by me, but by, you know, just AP wire, you know, just recounting what the daily death toll is, the amount of violence that's still going on, which is, you know, it's extraordinarily a high level. So I don't think people have much of a picture, but maybe it makes it easier to carry out a withdrawal if people have a sense that, you know, somehow they haven't been defeated. But, you know, what's the consequence going to be this? Well, you know, Iran is going to be becoming a regional power because the U.S., you know, rather to the amazement of the Iranians, managed to knock off their two main enemies, Saddam Hussein and the Taliban, on each side of Iran. So Iran has become a regional power. And Iraq is going to go on being dominated by the Shia religious parties, who have always been linked to Iran. You know, is there going to be an explosion in Iraq? I sort of doubt it. I mean, you have seen that there has been sort of arrests in Baghdad at the moment. There's the struggle for power at the top. But this may not turn into any real fighting for a few years. At the moment, I think things might stabilize, but at a very high, horrific level of violence, which is too much for the 5 million refugees to go home.
Yeah, the 5 million refugees that are completely or almost entirely undiscussed anywhere in mass media, even the European media that I try to read, very little coverage of the fact that there's still 5 million people who can't come home. But I guess, well, as you say, if there's any kind of benefit to this myth that the surge worked, maybe it's that the American people can finally somehow force our government to end this war, and they can save face by calling it a victory, whether they empower the Iranians or not, if they can leave Iraq somewhat stable, call it a win and call it a day.
Yeah, I mean, the only downside of that, Scott, is that it means that nobody much learns anything from what happened in Iraq. So maybe they'll do the same thing in Pakistan, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, you know. There isn't much that's been learnt from there. So the idea that you simply send more troops to Afghanistan and somehow things have come right are not contradicted by experience in Iraq, which is that, you know, occupation troops, yeah, sure, maybe they might secure a few roads, but The one thing that happens everywhere is that local people don't like it. There's a reaction against the occupation.
Right, and of course, Afghanistan is more like fighting in Colorado than fighting out in a flat desert somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, all these places are pretty, but it's a complicated, sort of messy place, particularly if you rely on air power, you know, with lots of civilian casualties. You know, these drones are being used in parts of Pakistan without asking Pakistani permission. That creates, I've just been in Pakistan, a big reaction locally against the U.S. This is one more sort of messy situation. You know, overall, you know, then you read stuff from some Washington think tanks describing Pakistan as a failed state or Afghanistan as a failed state. You know, but there's one lesson of the last sort of 20 or more years that I think Washington should accept is that failed states are real dangerous places. They may not have regular armies, but they've got, you know, these are societies who will fight for what they think are their own interests. You know, but
well,
Somalia,
and if they're ever going to
be a devastated place, you know, but these guys still fight.
Well, and if they're ever going to be a non-failed state, their government is going to have the legitimacy that comes from being supported by from the ground up, not from being installed by the United States from across the world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I was just watching this week, you know, that as I said, I'd just been in Pakistan, that Condoleezza Rice turned up to see the president and was at a press conference with him, and then Senator McCain turned up and was pictured with him, and then Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, did. Now, I guess these guys all think that this increases his power and influence. But, you know, to Pakistanis watching it, they think, hold on a minute, this guy is a foreign puppet. We only see him when he's with foreign leaders.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's a massive protest in Pakistan yesterday about the American trucks going from Karachi and then up through the Khyber Pass and in Afghanistan, which have been attacked lately, apparently to such a degree that we've had to ask the Russians to let us use some of their old supply lines into Afghanistan.
Sure. You
know,
this is pretty amazing. I mean, it wasn't just rockets. This was 200 or 300 armed guys in Peshawar, quite a large city. Simply thrashed the depots where these trucks were, which is the main U.S. and NATO supply line. Peshawar is the mouth of the Khyber Pass going up to Kabul. They simply took over these depots and shot the guards if they didn't run away, and set fire to all the Humvees. You know, this is a pretty amazing event.
Right. Well, all we got to do is surge into Afghanistan. Everything, I'm sure, will work out.
No,
I really want to thank you very much for your time on the show today, Patrick. It's been great.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. You can also find what he writes at counterpunch.org. And, oh, we still got, man, I don't even have time, I guess, to play this song before I tell you what I got to tell you. I got to tell you something. I don't want to say it, but I got to. This is my last show on Chaos Radio. Goodbye, Chaos Radio. It's been 7 years. You know, heartfelt thanks and all that stuff to all of my colleagues here at Chaos Radio, my fellow programmers, and all the people who've come and gone over the years, and everybody who tolerates me bogarting this station every day of the week the way I do. Especially thanks go to Bianca Oblivion for all the work she's done, and everybody else, you know who you are. I'm moving to Los Angeles. I have more to tell you, but I can't tell you it yet. But stay tuned to antiwar.com. It might be a couple of weeks. We'll still have some interviews going up at antiwar.com/radio. And then I guess also keep an eye on the stressblog.com in order to find out, and for that matter, the blog at antiwar.com, in order to find out any more news that might be coming your way. But I'm moving out to L.A. I'm done with Chaos Radio for at least the time being, and shit. I love you, Chaos. Thanks for having me. And we'll see what happens from here, you know? Always in motion is the future, said a great teacher of mine one time long ago. So that's it for Anti-War Radio. It's been a kick-ass couple of years, huh? And it's been a kick-ass 7 years on Chaos. The way shit is, the best I can tell, the weekend interview show, the Chaos Report, now Anti-War Radio. It's been awesome. Thanks for having me. See ya.